for soldiers serving in Afghanistan and Iraq, coming home is more lethal than being in combat. From the invasion of Afghanistan to the summer of 2009, the U.S. military lost 761 soldiers in combat in that country. Compare that to the 817 who took their own lives over the same period. And this number doesn't account for deaths related to violence, high-risk behaviors, and addiction. Craig Bryan, a University of Texas psychologist and suicide expert who recently left the Air Force, told Time magazine that the military finds itself in a catch-22. We train our warriors to use controlled violence and aggression, to suppress strong emotional reactions in the face of adversity, to tolerate physical and emotional pain, and to overcome the fear of injury and death. These qualities are also associated with increased risk for suicide. Bryan then explained that the military can't decrease the intensity of that conditioning, quote, without negatively affecting the fighting capability of our military, end quote. And he gave chilling expression to the inherent danger of looking at the world through the Viking or victim lens for those in the military when he noted, service members are, simply put, more capable of killing themselves by sheer consequence of their professional training. The situation may be at its most extreme in the military, but if you look at the mental and physical health statistics of police officers, you'll find the same thing. The same holds true in organizations when we lead, teach, or preach from a gospel of Viking or victim, win or lose. We crush faith, innovation, creativity, and adaptability to change. Take away the guns, in fact, and we find outcomes similar to those for soldiers and police in corporate America. Lawyers, an example of a profession largely trained in win or lose, succeed or fail, have outcomes that aren't much better. The American Bar Association reports that suicides among lawyers are close to 4 times greater than the rate of the general population. An American Bar Association Journal article reported that experts on lawyer depression and substance abuse attributed the higher suicide rates to lawyers' perfectionism and their need to be aggressive and emotionally detached. And this mentality can trickle down into our home lives as well. When we teach or model to our children that vulnerability is dangerous and should be pushed away, we lead them directly into danger and disconnection. The Viking or victim armor doesn't just perpetuate behaviors such as dominance, control, and power over folks who see themselves as Vikings. It can also perpetuate a sense of ongoing victimhood for people who constantly struggle with the idea that they're being targeted or unfairly treated. With this lens, there are only 2 possible positions that people can occupy, power over or powerless. In the interviews, I heard many participants sound resigned to victims simply because they didn't want to become the only alternative in their opinion. Vikings, perpetrators. Reducing our life options to such limited and extreme roles leaves very little hope for transformation and meaningful change. I think that's why there's often a sense of desperation and feeling boxed in around this perspective. So what's the Daring Greatly antidote to victim or Viking? It's redefining success, reintegrating vulnerability, and seeking support. To examine how the research participants moved from Viking to victim to engaging in vulnerability, there was a clear distinction between those who operated from this belief system because it's what they learned or it's a value they hold, and those who rely on this life lens as a result of trauma. Ultimately, the question that best challenges the logic behind Viking or victim for both groups is this: how are you defining success? It turns out in this win or lose, succeed or fail paradigm, Vikings are not victorious by any metric that most of us would label success. Survival or winning may be success in the midst of competition, combat, or trauma. But when the immediacy of that threat is removed, merely surviving is not living. As I mentioned earlier, love and belonging are irreducible needs of all people, and love and belonging are impossible to experience without vulnerability. Living without connection, without knowing love and belonging, is not victory. Fear and scarcity fuel the Viking or victim approach, and part of reintegrating vulnerability means examining shame triggers. What's fueling the win or lose fear? The people who made the shift from this paradigm to wholeheartedness all talked about cultivating trust and connection in relationships as a prerequisite for trying on a less combative way of engaging with the world. As far as connection in the military is concerned, I'm not advocating for a kinder, gentler fighting force. I understand the realities faced by nations and the soldiers who protect them. What I am advocating for is a kinder, gentler public, one willing to embrace support and reach out to the men and women we pay to be invulnerable on our behalf. Are we willing to reach out and connect? A great example of how connection can heal and transform is the work being done by Team Red, White, and Blue. According to their mission statement, they believe the most effective way to impact a veteran's life is through a meaningful relationship with someone in their community. Their program pairs wounded veterans with local volunteers. Together, they share meals, attend the veterans' medical appointments, go to local sporting events, and engage in other social activities. This interaction allows veterans to grow in their community, meet supportive people, and find new passions in life. My interest in this work not only stemmed from my research, but also from an extraordinary experience I had working with a group of veterans and military family members on a shame resilience project in one of my classes at the University of Houston. It changed my life. It made me realize how much we, the public, can do for veterans, and why our politics and beliefs about war shouldn't stop us from reaching out to them with vulnerability, compassion, and connection. I'll always be grateful for that experience and for what I've learned interviewing veterans about their experiences. For many of us who grieve over the wounds of war, we're missing an opportunity for healing that's right in front of us. Team Red, White, and Blue's motto, "It's Our Turn," is a call to action for all of us who want to do something to support vets. I'm working with them now, and I invite everyone to find a way to reach out. Dare greatly and take actions that communicate to veterans or military families that they are not alone. Actions that communicate, your struggle is my struggle. Your trauma is my trauma. Your healing is my healing. Trauma and daring greatly. We all struggle to understand why some people who have survived trauma, be it combat, domestic violence, sexual or physical abuse, or the quieter but equally devastating covert traumas of oppression, neglect, isolation, or living in extreme fear or stress, why some of these survivors exhibit tremendous resilience and lead full, wholehearted lives, while others become defined by their trauma. They may become perpetrators themselves of the violence they suffered, they struggle with addiction, or they're unable to escape the feeling that they are victims in situations where they're not. After studying shame, I knew that part of the answer was shame resilience. The people with the most resilience intentionally cultivated the four elements that we discussed in the earlier chapters. The other part of the answer felt elusive to me until I started my new research interviewing people about wholeheartedness and vulnerability. Then it made perfect sense. If we're forced into seeing the world through the Viking or victim lens as a survival mechanism, then it can feel impossible or even deadly to let go of that worldview. How can we expect someone to give up a way of seeing and understanding the world that has physically, cognitively, or emotionally kept them alive? None of us is ever able to part with our survival strategies without significant support and the cultivation of replacement strategies. Putting down the Viking or victim shield often requires help from a professional, someone who understands trauma. Groups are also very helpful. The research participants who survived trauma and are living wholehearted lives spoke passionately about the need to acknowledge the problem, seek professional help or support, work through the accompanying shame and secrecy, and approach the reintegration of vulnerability as a daily practice rather than a checklist item. One thing that we need to understand is that the greatest casualty of trauma is vulnerability itself. And when we think about the world we're living in right now, we think about how many people are subjected to trauma every day, just based on race, ethnicity, gender, immigration. Racism is trauma. Oppression is trauma. So in addition to these personal strategies for recovering and reintegrating vulnerability, every single one of us has the responsibility to work for a world that is more just, more equitable, and safer for everyone. Because no one deserves to live in trauma every single day just because of who they are in the world. The next shield we'll look at is letting it all hang out. I see two forms of oversharing in our culture. The first is what I call floodlighting, and the other is the smash and grab. As we discussed in the chapter on vulnerability myths, oversharing is not vulnerability. In fact, it often results in disconnection, distrust, and disengagement. Let's take a look at floodlighting. To understand floodlighting, we have to see that the intentions behind this kind of sharing are multifaceted and often include some combination of soothing one's pain, testing the loyalty and tolerance in a relationship, and or hotwiring a new connection. And by that I mean, look, we've only known each other for a couple of weeks, but I'm going to share this and now we'll be best friends. Unfortunately, for all of us who've done this, and I include myself in this group, the response is normally the opposite of what we're looking for. People recoil and shut down, compounding our shame and disconnection. You can't use vulnerability to discharge your own discomfort or as a tolerance barometer in a relationship. For example, I'll share this really hard thing and see if you stick around. You also can't use it to fast forward a relationship. It just won't cooperate. Ordinarily, when we reach out and share ourselves, our fears and hopes and struggles and joy, we create small sparks of connection. Our shared vulnerability creates light in normally dark places. My metaphor for this is twinkle lights. In fact, I keep them in my house year-round as a reminder. There's something magical about the idea of twinkle lights shining in dark and difficult places. The lights are small, and a single light is not very special. But an entire strand of sparkling lights is sheer beauty. It's the connectivity that makes them beautiful. When it comes to vulnerability, connectivity means sharing our stories with people who've earned the right to hear them. People with whom we've cultivated relationships that can bear the weight of our story. Is there trust? Is there mutual empathy? Is there reciprocal sharing? Can we ask for what we need? These are the crucial connection questions. When we share vulnerability, especially shame stories, with someone with whom there is no connectivity, their emotional and sometimes even physical response is often to wince, as if we're shining a floodlight in their eyes. Instead of a strand of delicate lights, our shared vulnerability is blinding, harsh, and unbearable. If we're on the receiving end, our hands fly up and cover our faces, we squeeze our entire faces, not just our eyes, shut, and we look away. When it's over, we feel depleted, confused, and sometimes even manipulated. Not exactly the empathic response that those telling the story were hoping for. Even for those of us who study empathy and teach empathy skills, it's rare that we're able to stay attuned when someone's oversharing stretches beyond the level of our connection with them. So let's look at the Daring Greatly strategies for oversharing. These include clarifying intentions, setting boundaries, and cultivating connection. Much of the beauty of light owes its existence to the dark. The most powerful moments of our lives happen when we string together the small flickers of light created by courage, compassion, and connection, and we see them shine in the darkness of our struggles. That darkness is lost when we use vulnerability to floodlight our listener, and the response is disconnection. We then use that disconnection as verification that we'll never find comfort, that we're not worthy, that the relationship is no good, or in the case of oversharing to hotwire a connection, that we'll never have the intimacy that we crave. We think, vulnerability is such a crock. It's not worth it. I'm not worth it. What we don't see is that using vulnerability is not the same thing as being vulnerable. It's the opposite. It's armor. Sometimes we're not even aware that we're oversharing as armor. We can purge our vulnerability or share our shame stories out of total desperation to be heard. We blurt out something that is causing us immense pain because we can't bear the thought of holding it in for one more second. Our intentions may not be purging or blurting to armor ourselves or push others away, but that's the exact outcome of our behaviors. Whether we're on the purging end or the receiving end of this experience, self-compassion is critical. We have to give ourselves a break when we share too much too soon, and we have to practice self-kindness when we feel like we weren't able to hold space for someone who just hit us with the floodlight. Judgment exacerbates disconnection. Hearing this, sometimes people ask me how I decide what to share and how to share it when it comes to my own work. I share a lot of myself in my work, and I certainly haven't cultivated trusting relationships with all of you or all of the people in the audiences where I speak. It's an important question, and the answer is that I don't tell stories or share vulnerabilities with the public until I've worked through them with the people I love. I have my own boundaries around what I share and what I don't share, and I always stay mindful of my intentions behind sharing. First, I only share stories or experiences that I've worked through, and I feel that I can share them from solid ground. I don't share what I define as intimate stories, nor do I share stories that are fresh wounds. I did that once or twice early in my career, and it was pretty terrible. There's nothing like staring into an audience of 1,000 people who are all giving you the floodlight look. Second, I follow the rule that I learned in my graduate social work training. Sharing yourself to teach or to move a process forward can be healthy and effective. But disclosing information as a way to work through your personal stuff is inappropriate and unethical. Last, I only share when I have no unmet needs that I'm trying to fill. I firmly believe that being vulnerable with a larger audience is only a good idea if the healing is tied to the sharing, not to the expectations I might have for the response I get. When I asked other people who share their stories through blogs and books and public speaking about this, it turns out that they are very similar in their approaches and intentions. I don't want the fear of floodlighting to stop anyone from sharing their struggles with the world. But being mindful about what, why, and how we share is important when the context is the larger public. We're all grateful for the people who write and speak in ways that help us remember that we're not alone. If you struggle a little bit or a lot with oversharing, this checklist might help. Ask yourself these questions. Why am I sharing this? What outcome am I hoping for? What emotions am I experiencing? Do my intentions around sharing align with my values? Is there an outcome, a response, or the lack of a response that will hurt my feelings? Is this sharing in the service of connection? Am I genuinely asking the people in my life for what I need? The next shield that's related to oversharing, that's a little bit different than floodlighting, is the smash and grab. If floodlighting is about misusing vulnerability, the second form of oversharing is all about using vulnerability as a manipulation tool. A smash and grab job is where the burglar smashes in a door or a store window and grabs what she or he can. It's sloppy, unplanned, and desperate. The smash and grab, used as vulnerability armor, is about smashing through people's social boundaries with intimate information, then grabbing whatever attention and energy you can get your hands on. We see this most in celebrity culture, where sensationalism thrives. Unfortunately, teachers and school administrators have told me that they see the same smash-and-grab behavior in students as young as middle school kids. Unlike floodlighting, which at least comes from a place of needing confirmation of our worthiness, this purported disclosure of vulnerability feels less real. I haven't interviewed enough people who engage in this behavior to fully understand the motivation, but what's emerged so far looks like attention-seeking. Of course, worthiness issues can and do underpin attention-seeking, but in our social media world, it's increasingly difficult to determine what's a real attempt to connect and what's performance. The only thing I do know is that it's not vulnerability. The Daring Greatly strategy to address the smash and grab is really about questioning intentions. This type of self-exposure feels one-directional, and for those who engage in it, an audience appears to be more desirable than intimate connection. If we find ourselves engaging in the smash and grab, I think the reality check questions are the same as the ones in the section on floodlighting. But I think it's also important to ask, what need is driving this behavior? And am I trying to reach, hurt, or connect with someone specifically? And is this the right way to do it? The next shield we're going to look at is what I call serpentining. I spent many years of my childhood in New Orleans, and my parents used to take me and my little brother to the swamp to go fishing. We would fish in the back channels running through the swampland owned by the company my dad worked for. One day when we were out fishing, this man who I promised looked like he was at least 110 came up and said, "Hey, if a gator comes at you, run a zigzag pattern. They're quick, but they ain't good at making turns." Well, as it turns out, a gator did lunge out of the water and ate the end of my mom's fishing pole, but we were never chased. And as it turns out, the whole thing about zigzagging or running in a serpentine pattern to escape is not true. According to the experts at the San Diego Zoo, we can easily outrun an alligator, zigzagging or not. They max out at a speed of about 10 or 11 miles per hour. And more importantly, they can't run very far. They depend on surprise attacks, not chasing down their prey. Zigzagging, or serpentining, is the perfect metaphor for how we spend enormous energy trying to dodge vulnerability when it would take far less effort to face it straight on, to walk right toward it. I have a tendency to want to zigzag or serpentine when I feel vulnerable. If I have to make a difficult call or have a hard conversation, I'll try to script both sides of it. I'll convince myself that I should wait. I'll draft an email while telling myself that it's better in writing. Then I'll think of a million other things to do. I'll emotionally run back and forth in a zigzag motion until I'm absolutely exhausted. When I catch myself trying to zigzag my way out of vulnerability, it helps to think about that alligator. The Daring Greatly strategy is stay present, pay attention, and move forward. The next shield we're going to talk about is cynicism, criticism, cool, and cruelty. If you decide to walk into the arena and dare greatly, you're going to get kicked around. It doesn't matter if your arena is politics or the PTO, or if your great dare is an article for your school newsletter, a promotion, or selling a piece of pottery on Etsy. You're going to be on the receiving end of some cynicism and criticism before it's over. There may even be some plain old mean-spiritedness. Why? Because cynicism, criticism, cruelty, and cool are even better than armor. They can be fashioned into weapons that not only keep vulnerability at a distance, but also can inflict injury on the people who are being vulnerable and making us uncomfortable. If we're the kind of people who don't do vulnerability, there's nothing that makes us feel more threatened and more incited to attack and shame people than to see someone daring greatly. Someone else's daring provides an uncomfortable mirror that reflects back our own fears about showing up, creating, and letting ourselves be seen. That's why we come out swinging. When we see cruelty, vulnerability is likely to be the driver. When I say criticism, I don't mean productive feedback, debate, and disagreement over the value or importance of a contribution. I'm talking about put-downs, personal attacks, and unfounded claims about our motivations and intentions. When I talk about cynicism, I don't mean healthy skepticism and questioning. I'm talking about the reflexive cynicism that leads to mindless responses like, "That's so stupid," or "What a loser idea." Cool is one of the most rampant forms of cynicism. Whatever. Totally lame. So uncool. Who gives a shit? Among some people, it's almost as if enthusiasm and engagement have become a sign of gullibility. Being too excited or invested makes you lame, a word that we've banned in our house, along with loser and stupid. In the introduction to the chapter, I talked about adolescence as the starting line for the race to the armory. Cynicism and cool are currency of the realm in middle school and high school. The motto is, too cool to care. As adults, we also protect ourselves from vulnerability with cool. We worry about being perceived as laughing too loud, buying in, caring too much, being too eager. We use our titles, education, background, and positions as handles on the shields of criticism, cynicism, cool, and cruelty. I can talk to you this way or blow you off because of who I am or what I do for a living. And make no mistake, when it comes to this shield, handles are also fashioned out of nonconformity and rejection of traditional status markers. I dismiss you because you've sold out and you spend your life in a cubicle. Or I'm more relevant and interesting because I rejected the trappings of higher education, traditional employment, etc. So what is the daring greatly solution for cool and cynicism and criticism? It's tightrope walking, practicing shame resilience, and reality checking. Over the course of 1 year, I interviewed artists, writers, innovators, business leaders, clergy, and community leaders about these issues and how they stayed open to the constructive, albeit difficult to hear, criticism while filtering out the mean-spirited attacks. Basically, I wanted to know how they maintained the courage to keep on walking into the arena. I'll confess that I was motivated by my own struggle to learn how to keep daring. Here's what I learned. When we stop caring about what people think, we lose our capacity for connection. When we become defined by what people think, we lose our willingness to be vulnerable. If we dismiss all of the criticism, we lose out on important feedback. But if we subject ourselves to the hatefulness, our spirits get crushed. It's a tightrope. Shame resilience is the balancing bar. And the safety net below is one or two people in our lives who can help us reality check the criticism and cynicism. I'm very visual, so I have a picture of a person walking on a tightrope hanging over my desk to remind me that working to stay open and at the same time to keep boundaries in place is worth the energy and risk. I actually used a Sharpie to write this across the balance bar. Worthiness is my birthright. It's both a reminder to practice shame resilience and a touchstone of my spiritual beliefs. And in case I'm feeling more vulnerable than usual, I have a little post-it note under my tightrope picture that reads, "Cruelty is cheap, easy, and chicken shit." That, too, is a touchstone of my spiritual beliefs. The research participants who had used criticism and cynicism in the past as a way to protect themselves from vulnerability had some very powerful wisdom to share about their transition to wholeheartedness. Many of them said that they grew up with parents who modeled that behavior and that they weren't aware of how fully they had mimicked it until they started investigating their own fear of being vulnerable, trying new things, and engaging. These folks were not egomaniacs who took pleasure in cutting down other people. In fact, they were consistently harder on themselves than they were on other people. So their mean-spiritedness wasn't only directed outward, even if they admitted that they often used it to lessen their own self-doubt. The first sentence of the Daring Greatly quote from Theodore Roosevelt says a lot. It's not the critic who counts. As for the people I interviewed who defined themselves as that critic, the not counting was definitely felt. They often struggled with feeling dismissed and invisible in their own lives. Criticizing was a way to be heard. When I asked how they moved from hurtful criticism to constructive criticism and from cynicism to contribution, they described a process that mirrored shame resilience, understanding what triggered their attack, what it means about their own sense of self-worth, talking to people they trust about it, and asking for what they need. Many of these folks had to dig deep about the cool issue. How did being perceived as cool become a driving value, and what was the cost of pretending that things don't matter? The fear of being vulnerable can unleash cruelty, criticism, and cynicism in all of us. Making sure we take responsibility for what we say is one way we can check our intentions. Dare greatly and put your name on your posted comments online. If you don't feel comfortable owning it, don't say it. And if you're listening to this and you have control over online sites that allow comments, then you should dare greatly and make users sign in, use real names, and hold the community responsible for creating a respectful environment. In addition to walking that tightrope, practicing shame resilience, and cultivating a safety net community that supports me when I'm feeling attacked or hurt, I've implemented two additional strategies. The first is simple. I only accept and pay attention to feedback from people who are also in the arena. If you're occasionally getting your butt kicked as you respond, and if you're also figuring out how to stay open to feedback without getting pummeled by insults, I'm more likely to pay attention to your thoughts about my work. If, on the other hand, you're not helping, contributing, or wrestling with your own gremlins, I'm really not at all interested in your commentary. The second strategy is also simple. I carry a small sheet of paper in my wallet that has written on it the names of people whose opinions of me matter. To be on that list, you have to love me for my strengths and struggles. You have to know that I'm trying to be wholehearted, but I still cuss too much, flip people off under the steering wheel, and have both Lawrence Welk and Metallica on my iPod. You have to know and respect that I'm totally uncool. In fact, there's a great quote from the movie Almost Famous that says, "The only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone else when you're uncool." To be on my list, you have to be what I call a stretch mark friend. Our connection has been stretched and pulled so much that it's become part of who we are, a second skin, and there are a few scars to prove it. We're totally uncool with each other. I don't think anyone has more than one or two people who qualify for that list. The important thing is not to discount the stretch mark friends to gain approval of the strangers who are being mean and nasty or are too cool. Nothing serves as a better reminder of that than the immortal words of my friend Scott Stratton, author of Unmarketing. Don't try to win over the haters. You're not the jackass whisperer. Chapter 5. Mind the Gap. Cultivating change and closing the disengagement divide. Minding the gap is a daring strategy. We have to pay attention to the space between where we're actually standing and where we want to be. More importantly, we have to practice the values that we're holding out as important in our culture. Minding the gap requires both an embrace of our own vulnerability and cultivation of shame resilience. We're going to be called upon to show up as leaders and parents and educators in new and uncomfortable ways. We don't have to be perfect, just engaged and committed to aligning values with action. Mind the Gap first appeared in 1969 on the London Underground as a warning to train passengers to be careful while stepping over the gap between the train door and the station platform. It has since become the name of a band and a movie, and the phrase has been captured on everything from t-shirts to doormats. In our house, we have a small framed Mind the Gap postcard that reminds us to pay attention to the space between where we're standing and where we want to go. Let me explain. Strategy versus culture. In the business world, there's an ongoing debate about the relationship between strategy and culture and the relative importance of each. Just to define the terms, I think of strategy as the game plan or the detailed answer to the question, what do we want to achieve and how are we going to get there? We all, families, religious groups, project teams, teachers from the kindergarten cluster, we all have game plans. And we all think about the goals we want to accomplish and the steps we need to take to be successful. Culture, on the other hand, is less about what we want to achieve and more about who we are. Out of the many complex definitions of culture, including those that weighed down my undergrad sociology textbooks, the one that resonates the most with me is the simplest. As organizational development pioneers Terence Deal and Alan Kennedy explained it, culture is the way we do things around here. I like this definition because it rings true for discussions about all cultures, from the larger culture of scarcity that I write about in the first chapter, to a specific organizational culture, to the culture that defines my family. Some form of debate about what's more important, strategy or culture, bubbles up in every conversation I have with leaders. One camp subscribes to the famous quote often attributed to thought leader Peter Drucker, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast." Other folks believe that pitting one against the other creates a false dichotomy and that we need both. Interestingly, I've yet to find a strong argument that strategy is more important than culture. I think everyone agrees, in theory, that who we are is at least as important as what we want to achieve. While some complain that the debate is old and too chicken or egg to be helpful, I think it's a critically relevant discussion for organizations. Maybe more importantly, I think examining these issues can transform families, schools, and communities. The way we do things around here, or culture, is complex. In my experience, I can tell a lot about a culture and values of a group, family, or organization by asking these 10 questions. 1. What behaviors are rewarded or punished? 2. Where and how are people actually spending their resources, their time, money, and attention? 3. What rules and expectations are followed, enforced, and ignored? 4. Do people feel safe and supported talking about how they feel and asking for what they need? 5. What are the sacred cows? Who's most likely to tip them? And who stands the cows back up? 6. What stories are legend and what values do they convey? 7. What happens when someone fails, disappoints, or makes a mistake? 8. How is vulnerability, uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure perceived? 9. How prevalent are shame and blame, and how are they showing up? And last, number 10, what's the collective tolerance for discomfort? Is the discomfort of learning, trying new things, and giving and receiving feedback normalized? Or is there a high premium put on comfort? And how does that look? In each of the following sections, I'll talk about how these play out in our lives and what specifically I look for. But first, I want to talk about where this line of questioning leads us. As someone who studies culture as a whole, I think the power of these questions is their ability to shed light on the darkest areas of our lives, disconnection, disengagement, and our struggle for worthiness. Not only do these questions help us understand the culture, they surface the discrepancies between what we say and what we do, or between the values we espouse and the values we practice. My dear friend Charles Kiley uses the term aspirational values to describe the elusive list of values that reside in our best intentions, on the wall of our cubicle, at the heart of our parenting lectures, or in our company's vision statement. If we want to isolate the problems and develop transformation strategies, we have to hold our aspirational values up against what I call our practice values, how we actually live, feel, behave, and think. Are we walking our talk? Answering this question can get very uncomfortable. The disengagement divide. Here's my theory. Disengagement is the issue underlying the majority of problems I see in families, schools, communities, and organizations, and it takes many forms, including the ones we discussed in the Armory chapter. We disengage to protect ourselves from vulnerability, shame, and feeling lost and without purpose. We also disengage when we feel like the people who are leading us, our boss, our teachers, our principal, our clergy, our parents, our politicians, aren't living up to their end of the social contract. Politics is a great, albeit painful, example of social contract disengagement. Politicians on both sides of the aisle are making laws that they're not required to follow or that don't affect them. They're engaging in behaviors that would result in most of us getting fired, divorced, or arrested. They're espousing values that are rarely displayed in their behavior. And just watching them shame and blame each other is degrading for us. They're not living up to their side of the social contract, and voter turnout statistics show that we're disengaging. Religion is another example of social contract disengagement. First, disengagement is often the result of leaders not living by the same values they're preaching. Second, in an uncertain world, we often feel desperate for absolutes. It's the human response to fear. When religious leaders leverage our fear and need for more certainty by extracting vulnerability from spirituality and turning faith into compliance and consequences, rather than teaching and modeling how to wrestle with the unknown and how to embrace mystery, the entire concept of faith is bankrupt on its own terms. Faith minus vulnerability equals politics, or worse, extremism. Spiritual connection and engagement is not built on compliance. It's the product of love, belonging, and vulnerability. So here's the question. We don't intentionally create cultures in our families, schools, communities, and organizations that fuel disengagement and disconnection. So how does it happen? Where's the gap? The gap starts here. We can't give people what we don't have. Who we are matters immeasurably more than what we know or who we want to be. The space between our practice values, what we're actually doing, thinking, and feeling, and our aspirational values, what we want to do, think, and feel, is the value gap, or what I call the disengagement divide. It's where we lose our employees, our clients, and our students, our teachers, our congregations, even our own children. We can take big steps. We can even make a running jump to cross the widening value fissures that we face at home, work, and school. But at some point, when that divide broadens to a certain critical degree, we're goners. That's why dehumanizing culture fosters the highest levels of disengagement. They create value gaps that actual humans can't hope to successfully navigate. Let's take a look at some common issues that arise in the context of families. I'm using family examples because we're all part of families. Even if we don't have children, we were raised by adults. In each case, a significant gap has grown between the practiced values and the aspirational values, creating that dangerous disengagement divide. In this first example, the family's aspirational values are honesty and integrity. But the practiced values are rationalizing and letting things slide. Mom is always telling her kids that honesty and integrity are important, and that stealing and cheating in school won't be tolerated. As they pile into the car after a long grocery shop, Mom realizes that the cashier didn't charge her for the sodas in the bottom of the cart. Rather than going back into the store, she shrugs and says, "Well, wasn't my fault. They're making a mint anyway." The second example, the aspirational values are respect and accountability. But what's being practiced is fast and easy as more important. Dad is always driving home the importance of respect and accountability. But when Bobby intentionally breaks Sammy's new transformer, Dad is too busy on his BlackBerry to sit down with the brothers and talk about how they should treat each other's toys. Instead of insisting that Bobby needs to apologize and make amends, he shrugs his shoulders thinking, boys will be boys, and tells them both to go to their rooms. In this third example, the aspirational values are gratitude and respect. But what's being practiced is teasing, taking for granted, and disrespect. Mom and Dad constantly feel underappreciated, and they're tired of their children's disrespectful attitudes. But Mom and Dad themselves yell at each other and call each other names. No one in the house says please or thank you, including the parents. Moreover, Mom and Dad use put-downs with their children and with each other, and everyone routinely teases family members to the point of tears. The problem is that the parents are looking for behaviors, emotions, and thinking patterns that their children have never seen modeled. In this last scenario, the aspirational values are setting limits. But the practice values are that rebellion and cool are portrayed as important in this family. Julie is 17 and her younger brother Austin is 14. Julie and Austin's parents have a zero tolerance policy for cigarettes, alcohol, and drugs. Unfortunately, that policy isn't working. Both kids have been caught smoking, and Julie has just been suspended because her teacher found vodka in her water bottle at school. Julie looks at her parents and screams, "You're such hypocrites! What about those wild parties y'all used to throw in high school? What about that time when Mom went to jail? Y'all thought that was so funny, you told us about it. You even showed us pictures." Now, let's take a look at the power of aligned values. The aspirational values here are emotional connection and honored feelings. The practice values are also emotional connection and honored feelings. Mom and Dad have tried to instill and model a feelings-first ethic in their family. One evening, Hunter comes home from basketball practice and is clearly upset. His sophomore year has been tough, and the basketball coach is really riding him. He throws his bag down on the kitchen floor and heads straight upstairs. Mom and Dad are in the kitchen making dinner, and they watch Hunter as he disappears up to his room. Dad turns off the burner, and Mom tells Hunter's younger brother that they're going to talk to Hunter and to please give them some time alone with him. They go upstairs together and sit on the edge of his bed. "Your mom and I know these past few weeks have been really hard," Dad says. "We don't know exactly how you feel, but we want to know. High school was tough for both of us, and we want to be with you in this. I think this is such a great example of minding the gap and cultivating engagement. In the interview, the father told me that it made all of them feel very vulnerable and that they were all crying before it was over. He said that sharing his high school struggles with his son really opened the relationship between them." I want to stress that these examples aren't fiction. They're from the data. And no, we can't be perfect models all the time. I know I can't. But when our practiced values are routinely in conflict with the expectations we set in our culture, disengagement is inevitable. If Mom is exhausted after the grocery shop and drives away without paying once, it might not be a big deal. If the "I can get away with it and it's not my fault" is her norm, she needs to adjust her expectations around her kids cheating. If she drives away without paying, but then sits her kids down and says, "I should have gone back in and paid for the soda. It doesn't matter whose fault it was. I'm going back to the store today." Well, that's incredibly powerful. The lesson here is, I do want to live by my values, and it's okay to be imperfect and make mistakes in this house. We just need to make it right when we can. The example about the vodka illustrates a common struggle I hear from parents all of the time. I was wild, they say. I did things I don't want my kids to do. Should I lie about my escapades? As a former wild person, I don't think the issue is whether to lie or not to lie. It's about what we share and how we share it. First, not everything we do or did is our children's business. Just as, when they're adults, not everything they do is our business. So we should examine the motivation for sharing a particular story and let the question about what we're teaching drive our decision. Second, having an honest talk with our kids about drugs and alcohol and our experiences with either or both can be helpful. But framing our numbing or party experiences as cool war stories and placing importance on being rebellious may eventually be at odds with the values we want our children to develop. Remember the debate about culture and strategy? I think both are important, and I think we need daring strategies to develop daring cultures. As these examples of aspirational values versus practice values demonstrate, if we want to reconnect and reengage, we have to mind the gap. Minding the gap is a daring strategy. We have to pay attention to the space between where we're actually standing and where we want to be. More importantly, we have to practice the values that we're holding out as important in our culture. Minding the gap requires both an embrace of our own vulnerability and cultivation of shame resilience. We're going to be called upon to show up as leaders and parents and educators in new and uncomfortable ways. We don't have to be perfect, just engaged and committed to aligning values with action. We also need to be prepared. The gremlins will be out in full force, as they love to sneak up just when we're about to step into the arena, to be vulnerable and to take some chances. In the next two chapters, I'm going to use the concepts I've introduced here to jump right in and tell you what I think we need to do to cultivate engagement and to transform the way we parent, educate, and lead. These three questions will guide the following chapters. 1. How does the culture of never enough affect our schools, organizations, and families? 2. How do we recognize and combat shame at work, school, and home? And 3. What does minding the gap and daring greatly look like in schools, organizations, and families? Chapter 6. Disruptive Engagement. Daring to rehumanize education and work. To reignite creativity, innovation, and learning, leaders must rehumanize education and work. This means understanding how scarcity is affecting the way we lead and work, learning how to engage with vulnerability, and recognizing and combating shame. Make no mistake, honest conversations about vulnerability and shame are disruptive. The reason that we're not having these conversations in our organizations is that they shine light in dark corners. Once there is language, awareness, and understanding, turning back is almost impossible and carries with it severe consequences. We all want to dare greatly. If you give us a glimpse into that possibility, we'll hold on to it as our vision. It can't be taken away. Before we start this chapter, I want to clarify what I mean by leader. I've come to believe that a leader is anyone who holds her or himself accountable for finding potential in people and processes and developing that potential. The term leader has nothing to do with position, status, or number of direct reports. I wrote this chapter for all of us, parents, teachers, community volunteers, and CEOs, anyone who is willing to dare greatly and lead. The challenge of leading in a culture of never enough. In 2010, I had the opportunity to spend a long weekend with 50 CEOs from Silicon Valley. One of the other speakers at the retreat was Kevin Cerace, the then CEO of Sirius Materials and Inc. Magazine's 2009 Entrepreneur of the Year. I knew Kevin was going to speak about disruptive innovation, so in my first conversation with him, before either one of us had spoken to the group and before he knew about my work, I asked him this question. What's the most significant barrier to creativity and innovation? Kevin thought about it for a minute and said, "You know, I don't know if it has a name, but honestly, it's the fear of introducing an idea and being ridiculed, laughed at, and belittled. If you're willing to subject yourself to that experience, and if you survive it, Then it becomes the fear of failure and the fear of being wrong. People believe they're only as good as their ideas, and that their ideas can't seem too out there, and they can't not know everything. The problem is that innovative ideas often sound crazy, and failure and learning are part of the revolution. Evolution and incremental change is important, and we need it. But we're desperate for real revolution, and that requires a different type of courage and creativity. Before that conversation, I had never specifically asked the leaders I'd interviewed about innovation. But everything Kevin was saying fit with my data on work and education. I smiled and responded, "It's true, isn't it? Most people in most organizations can't stand the uncertainty and risk of real innovation. Learning and creating are inherently vulnerable. There's never enough certainty. People want guarantees." He simply said, "Yes, again, I'm not sure if there's a name for the problem, but something related to fear keeps people from going for it. They focus on what they already do well, and they don't put themselves out there." There was a slight pause in our conversation before he looked at me and said, "So I understand you're a researcher. What exactly do you do?" I laughed. "I study that something related to fear that you're talking about. I'm a shame and vulnerability researcher." When I got back to my hotel room, I grabbed my research journal and made notes about my conversation with Kevin. As I thought about that something related to fear, I remembered another set of notes that I had written in that same journal. I flipped back until I found the field notes that I had taken after talking to a group of middle school students about their classroom experiences. When I asked them to describe the key to learning, one girl gave the following reply, while the others passionately nodded their heads and said, "Yes, that's it, and exactly." There are times when you can ask questions or challenge ideas, but if you've got a teacher that doesn't like that, or the kids in the class make fun of people who do that, it's bad. I think most of us learn that it's just best to keep your head down, your mouth shut, and your grades high. As I reread this passage in my notes and thought about my conversation with Kevin, I was overwhelmed. And as a teacher, I felt heartbreak. We can't learn when our heads are down and our mouths are shut. At the time, I was the mother of a middle schooler and a kindergartner. I just found it infuriating. As a researcher, it was the moment when I started to realize how often the struggles of our education system and the challenges we face in our workplace mirror each other. I first envisioned this chapter as two separate discussions, one for educators and one for leaders. But as I looked back on the data, I realized that teachers and school administrators are leaders. C-level executives, managers, and supervisors are teachers. No corporation or school can thrive in the absence of creativity, innovation, and learning. And the greatest threat to all three of these is disengagement. Given what I've learned from the research and what I've observed over the past couple of years as I've worked with leaders from schools and companies of all sizes and types, I believe we have to completely re-examine the idea of engagement. I call it disruptive engagement for this reason. To reignite creativity, innovation, and learning, leaders must rehumanize education and work. This means understanding how scarcity is affecting the way we lead and work, learning how to engage with vulnerability, and recognizing and combating shame. Sir Ken Robinson speaks to the power of making this shift in his appeal to leaders to replace the outdated idea that human organizations should work like machines with a metaphor that captures the realities of humanity. In his book, Out of Our Minds, Learning to Be Creative, Robinson writes, "However seductive the machine metaphor may be for industrial production, human organizations are not actually mechanisms, and people are not components in them. People have values and feelings, perceptions, opinions, motivations, and biographies, whereas cogs and sprockets do not. An organization is not the physical facilities within which it operates. It is the networks of people in it." Make no mistake, rehumanizing work and education requires courageous leadership. Honest conversations about vulnerability and shame are disruptive. The reason that we're not having these conversations in our organizations is that they shine light in the dark corners. Once there is language, awareness, and understanding, turning back is almost impossible and carries with it severe consequences. We all want to dare greatly. If you give us a glimpse into that possibility, we'll hold on to it as our vision. It can't be taken away. Recognizing and combating shame, Shame breeds fear. It crushes our tolerance for vulnerability, thereby killing engagement, innovation, creativity, productivity, and trust. And worst of all, if we don't know what we're looking for, shame can ravage our organizations before we see one outward sign of a problem. Shame works like termites in a house. It's hidden in the dark behind the walls and constantly eating away at our infrastructure until one day the stairs suddenly crumble. Only then do we realize that it's only a matter of time before the walls come tumbling down. In the same way that a casual walk around our house won't reveal a termite problem, a stroll through an office or a school won't necessarily reveal a shame problem. Or at least we hope it's not that obvious. If it is, if we see a manager berating an employee or a teacher shaming a student, the problem is already acute and more than likely has been happening for a long time. In most cases, though, we have to know what we're looking for when we assess an organization for signs that shame may be an issue. Signs that shame has permeated the culture. Blaming, gossiping, favoritism, name-calling, and harassment are all behavior cues that shame has permeated a culture. A more obvious sign is when shame becomes an outright management tool. Is there evidence of people in leadership roles bullying others, criticizing subordinates in front of colleagues, delivering public reprimands, or setting up reward systems that intentionally belittle, shame, or humiliate people? I've never been to a shame-free school or organization. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but I doubt it. In fact, once I've explained how shame works, I normally have one or two teachers approach me and explain that they use shame on a daily basis. Most ask how to change the practice, but a few proudly say, it works. The best case scenario is that it's a limited or contained problem rather than a cultural norm. One reason that I'm confident that shame exists in schools is simply because 85% of the men and women we interviewed for the shame research could recall a school incident from their childhood that was so shaming it changed how they thought of themselves as learners. What makes this even more haunting is that approximately half of those recollections were what I refer to as creativity scars. The research participants could point to a specific incident where they were told or shown that they weren't good writers, artists, musicians, dancers, or something creative. I still see this happening in schools all the time. Art is graded on narrow standards, and kids as young as kindergarten are told they have no creative gifts. This helps explain why the gremlins are so powerful when it comes to creativity and innovation. Corporations have their own struggles. The Workplace Bullying Institute defines bullying as repeated mistreatment, sabotage by others that prevented work from getting done, verbal abuse, threatening conduct, intimidation, and humiliation. A 2010 poll conducted by Zogby International for the Workplace Bullying Institute reported that an estimated 54 million American workers, 37% of the U.S. workforce, have been bullied at work. Furthermore, another World Bullying Institute study revealed that 52.5% of the time, bullied workers reported that employers basically did nothing to stop the bullying. When we see shame being used as a management tool, and again, that means bullying, criticism in front of colleagues, public reprimands, or reward systems that intentionally belittle people, we need to take direct action because it means that we've got an infestation on our hands. And we need to remember that this doesn't just happen overnight. Equally important to keep in mind is that shame is like the other SH word. Like shit, shame rolls downhill. If employees are constantly having to navigate shame, you can bet that they're passing it along to their customers, students, and families. So if it's happening and it can be isolated to a specific unit, work team, or person, it has to be addressed immediately and without shame. We learn shame in our families of origin, and many people grow up believing that it's an effective and efficient way to manage people, run a classroom, and parent. For that reason, shaming someone who's using shame is not helpful. But doing nothing is equally dangerous, not only for the people who are the targets of the shaming, but also for the entire organization. Several years ago, a man came up to me after an event and said, "Interview me, please. I'm a financial advisor, and you would not believe what happens in my office." When I met Don for the interview, he told me that in his organization, you choose your office each quarter based on your quarterly results. The person with the best results chooses first and sends the person in